Finding Hope in Our Differences, Unity and Diversity Workshop. My name is Pat. I'm a compulsive overeater. Let's start the meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. This workshop format is three speakers for 20 minutes each, and then the floor will be opened for two-minute shares or for questions for the speakers. I'd like to introduce Cheryl. She's going to do some introductory remarks for our speakers.
Hi, I'm Cheryl, compulsive overeater. I'm really happy to be here and see you all. Just wanted to start out by saying there's not one way of working this program, as the only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. There are as many ways to work the program as there are people in it. This fact gives us all hope that we all, no matter how we are compulsive about our food or weight, no matter our gender, spiritual choices, ethnicity, political persuasion, age, neurological or physical differences, sexual orientation, or other identity, both belong in this community and can find a path that leads us out of insanity. I put my hands in yours, and together we can do what we could never do alone. Whether we are at a men's group, a free thinkers meeting, an LGBTQIA meeting, or any other meeting with a focus group or even a general meeting, there are people with open arms to share their experience, strength, and hope. There are people willing to trudge the road of happy destiny with us that, given all other circumstances, we would never know, but our disease has brought us together. People who do amazing service, answer calls, show up to meetings, and otherwise contribute to our mission of reaching the compulsive eater who still suffers. We can only do this with our diversity and our unity. So today, Eva, Jared, and I will share our diversity experience, strength, and hope of all of our programs. If you hear something you like, take it. If you hear something you don't think will work for you, great. You're closer to finding the path that does work for you. Thank you all for your support, acceptance, and love. And with that, I can hand it right over to Eva.
Hello, everybody. My name is Eva. I'm in recovery from bulimia, but I have an eating disorder. So I have gone through many different manifestations of the illness. So I have had periods of overeating and restricting as well. But first of all, I want to say thank you for giving me this opportunity to share. I'm so glad and grateful to having this chance. And thank you everybody for the organization and everything. Thinking about differences, I would like to talk to you guys about geographic here as a manifestation of isolation and denial. So currently I'm 39 years old. And so far, I've lived in 4 different countries, 11 different cities, and 36 different houses. And as you can see, I had spent a good part of my life running. And that's exactly what I define as isolation. I'm going to go a little bit through my history to explain it. So my father, he was one of 13 sisters and brothers from a Colombian family. My mom, she was one of 10 sisters and brothers from a Mexican French family. They were opposite. As Colombian, my dad used to be pretty open about many things. And while my mom was super conservative, she was always ready to judge and to put tags on things as good or bad. And those cultural differences in my home created a lot of illness. And I want to be clear about this because it doesn't mean that it has to be the same in each and every multicultural family. But in my family, there was also addiction. And maybe the addiction is not a problem as well. But the problem was that nobody was willing to accept or recognize or be aware or do something. So there was continuous conflict in my family, in my house. There was arguments. And my dad and my mom, they were arguing all the time. It was crazy because when he came from Colombia to Mexico, he met him and 2 months later they were married and they never separated again until he passed away. But they also never stopped arguing. That's crazy. But I remember I had to get involved as a little kid in their arguments and try to solve the conflict. The thing was that nobody was willing to recognize mistakes or negotiate. And instead, we were moving all the time. Every year, a different house, a different city, sometimes a different country. So living in the middle of this chaos, it feel like what I feel as a kid that is that there was no room for me and my three sisters and my one brother. It feel like there were no safety or no limits. It felt like nobody was in charge at home. Everybody was playing different roles, except the role that we really have to play as kids, as mom, as dad. So I felt always like invisible until I realized that becoming a role model made me important in front of my parents. So at a very young age, maybe 9 or so, I was playing the role of an adult. And that made me really feel like I was essential and important for my parents and gave me a fake sense of belonging and safety and worthiness, but also a lot of stress. It put a lot of stress on me. But that was my choice to cope with life. So that is how I became the hero of the family. And that's when I started thinking that having control and doing whatever it takes to have control was right. And I also started believing that asking for help was wrong, because guess what? People could think that I was a burden. And that could mean for me that they would stop loving me and seeing me. And that was not possible. So I was living as an adult, as a grown up, being a kid. So obviously isolation was behind all that, because I grew up pleasing other people acting according to their expectations in order to gain their love. And inside of me was absolute disconnection. So that was for me the price that I had to pay to be seen and loved. I would define myself and idea, and I realized that later when I started recovery as a person, as a completely empty person. And maybe the only thing that keeps me away from being completely empty was all the fear, all the anguish, all the sadness, uncertainty, frustration, anger that I could never express, because there was really no time for that in my house. And I think that has a lot to do with my parents being addicted to something. My dad, he was an alcoholic, and my mom, she was codependent. And they had, of course, their own history behind that. But the thing is that in my house, there was a lot of denial. So feeling was not allowed. And expressing what you feel was okay, but there was no echo. So by the age of 14, I was really, really tired about the environment in my house. And I decided to leave home. I decided to stop living with my parents. And it was easy for me to convince them, because when you play the role model since you're a kid, I pretty quick learned how to manipulate my parents, and I knew what to say and what not to say to persuade them of letting me do whatever I wanted to do. So since I was a hero, I said that I need to move from home. I need to go away to another place with a better level of education, you know, because I need a proper education. So leaving home, not knowing absolutely nothing about myself and being absolutely disconnected from myself, that's exactly when the bomb exploded. And it started as overeating. I remember that since I was 9, I had these episodes when I couldn't stop eating, but I never paid attention to that until that became a regular practice in my life. And that was exactly when I was 14 years old. And so there I was. I moved from a state of Mexico to the capital city, which is Mexico City. It's a huge place. And I was there trying to face my own life with all my wonderful tools. Because as you probably know, we all have tools. And those, the ones that I developed to cope with life as a little kid, were the ones that I was still using to live my life. And to mention some of them, I was living in total denial. I was living as a victim all the time, because for me, it was better, it was easier to find somebody to blame than take responsibility. I was living with a lot of shame as well. I had always this need to be right. I was absolutely crazy perfectionist. And I was arrogant as well, you know, because what happened for me, and that just made isolation even more strong, was that I became really arrogant because I was solving my parents' problems as a kid. So for me, I trust nobody, and nobody could do things better than I did. So fear was behind all that all the time. Fear. So the truth is that bulimia became my partner in crime to live my life. And I could do it because I had the mission to serve my family. And that really keeps me away from sanity for a long, 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 long time in my life. I had the mission to save my family from their own misery, let's say. I remember I was told that I was the strongest of the family. And I really wanted to believe that because that was my strongest connection with my parents. So I did it at a very, very, very high price. But I did it. And it was bulimia, it was anorexia, it was overeating. But essentially for me, it was living in obsession, because that obsession is exactly what I needed to numb my reality. Because you guys, doesn't matter what I was feeling or what's going on, it never felt right to be me, never. I needed to run from myself all the time. And again, that's what I call isolation. And I was moving all the time, physically moving all the time. That was good for me. And that's something that became an addiction for me too. It took me so many, many, many years to stop purging. But I would say that it's not more than saying that to stop. I would say it took me a long time to really, really want it to stop. Because at the end, I was getting benefits from this disorder too. So before I hit rock bottom, I tried all kinds of things. I tried nutritionist, I tried psychologist, psychiatry, yoga, meditation. I don't know, maybe I think my mom, he took me to see a witch. We say a witch in Mexico, so to take me away from this. But it was not working. Nothing worked. And of course, it wasn't gonna work because I kept living my life the same way, with the same habits, with the same mechanisms and the same patterns. And so those were my mechanisms. Those were my tools as a little kid to cope with life. And I didn't want to let them go because they were my lifesavers. And who wants to jump in the open sea with no lifesaver? So every time I tried to stop, I remember I felt like I couldn't breathe. So I went back to my patterns. And it was crazy because the more I consumed, the more misery I created in my life, and vice versa. So when I was like 16 years later, I finally got to AA. And for me, that was a miracle. That was a miracle. That was a gift from my higher power. And there I found in AA exactly the company that provided me the courage to finally jump. And the only difference this time is that I had a sense of belonging. And that people in OA knew exactly what I was going through, and they were there witnessing and understanding what was going on with me. So they were seeing me, they were feeling me, they were not judging me, they got me. And it was crazy. This is a crazy, crazy part, because even when I was there experimenting all that, I really didn't feel like connecting with people. That was crazy. So since I spent 30 years of my life knowing and forgetting different people all the time, that was like an addiction for me too. Because it was easier. It was easier living that way and not having to establish any connection with people and not allowing people to see me as I was. But I was doing the same inside me with myself. Also, because that would mean to be vulnerable. And for me, remember, vulnerability has a lot to do with people stop loving me. So until I realized that the reason of that feeling was that I was still pretty away from myself, rejecting my own nature, and I had to start talking about it. So I did it, and it worked. It worked because no matter how peculiar we are, all of us in OA, and my God, we are peculiar. We are. So, but we share the same thing because we were in the same darkness and we're sharing the same, we are seeing the light. So for the first time in my life, when I finally opened myself to the world, that in my case was OA, because that was the only place where I really, really, really felt like letting other people see myself as I was. So for the first time in my life, I was willing to show myself just exactly as I was, and I didn't need to run anymore. Instead of running, I took the time, and that's what I do every single day of my life, to identify all those mechanisms to cope with life that are wrong. So what I do is, let's say that I detect or I realize that I'm being the victim. So, okay, then I remind me that being the victim is okay, but that being the victim is not having the freedom. And being the victim is going slowly back to where I was before recovery. And that's not a place where I want to be. That's what I do. I try to live my life with so much awareness and not allowing those mechanisms to repeat in my life, because that's exactly where isolation starts. And that's exactly where my addiction becomes stronger. So that worked for me. I don't know, it may or not work for you guys, but doesn't matter, because even when we're different, we can still find recovery together, and we can still find life together. And as far as moving, I don't fight anymore with that. I think I'm going to keep doing that because that's something I like. And it's okay. Moving is not a problem as long as I understand that when I move, my home moves with me, and my home is myself. I realize now that belonging starts with my relationship with myself. That's where it starts. And that's what I try to take care of every single day of my life. So now I keep moving. Actually, I just moved from Mexico to LA 2 months ago. Even when I move, I try to leave home the most part of the time. And I have a family now, you guys, the family that follows me everywhere I go, and that's you. So that's all I have. Thank you so much.
Eva, thank you so much for your share. Really appreciate it. And thank you to all who are doing service. It's a privilege to get to share today. Super stoked. So I'm Jared. Yeah, who just so happens to be a he, him, you know, privileged, heteronormal. I'm religious. You know, I have a spiritual connection to a common culture, you know, higher power. I identify as an addict. Compulsive overeating is my first of many other compulsions. Happy to talk with people about that offline. I identify as a mental health. I'm challenged with mental health issues, depression, anxiety. I actually have dyslexia, so I identify as a disability. So I'm really grateful actually for the audible readings of our literature. I also identify on the LGBTQIA spectrum as a bisexual, homoemotional, and I'm a father of young kids. So I'm a divorced dad, a regretful dad, actually. And that's just to have no secrets, as well as I do identify as a great dad, one who is intentional. I'm to qualify for speaking tonight. I have been abstinent from recreational sugar for about 4 years now. I'm closely working with a sponsor. A quick shout out. I think this person is in this meeting out there. And I've been keeping on coming back to meetings. So I haven't really had a period where I fell out of coming back. And it really comes down to the wisdom of the rooms. And so for that, you know, I just want to open up with a gratitude there. I'm going to quickly run through what it was like, what changed, and kind of like what it's like now. So I'm a kid from Akron, Ohio. I always thought it was a coincidence being from Akron, Ohio, for those big book studiers, Dr. Bob Smith, the hometown there. I always had anxiety as a young kid and codependent. I was definitely people pleaser as a middle child. I had an older brother and a younger brother. And I'm a child of alcoholic lineage. So my parents actually didn't drink, but their parents' parents drank. So my parents actually, you know, I'm really proud of them for stopping the drink. But one of the things that they kind of converted that disease into was eating. So we ate out a ton, 6 to 7 nights a week. So I pretty much memorized the Applebee's menu. And actually, I had a quick question for the host. Is it okay if I talk about specific foods?
I believe that'll work. We just don't glorify a particular food, but go for it, Jared.
Okay. I think it's mostly to be hyperbolic in the color of what I want to share. So for those that need to, please guard your hearts. But I think it's more artistic in the way that I want to express. So, you know, with that, like, I knew the Applebee's menu. I knew tequila lime chicken, you know, with French fries. My brothers and I fought over Cinnamon Toast Crunch as soon as mom got home. So that bag and box lasted for about 20 minutes. A normal lunch for me during, you know, my high school years was 2 Lender's bagels, 2 Country Time lemonades, and a strawberry shortcake bar. And really the in sum there is that I used food to manage my feelings. And so, you know, during high school, you know, I found ways to kind of convert that because optically, if you become fat, you know, people start observing. So I ended up finding cigarettes, coffee, and some activities like chess and golf to kind of hide. And I ended up starting running as well. So looking back, I definitely could see myself as an exercise bulimic, but at the same time too, it did help me with my, you know, regulated feelings. When I went to school, really didn't feel like going to college, but my dad, you know, definitely forced me to go. And it was funny because during then I, you know, put on the freshman 50, stress eating, things like that, but found a sport called Ultimate Frisbee, which actually is what brought me here to Seattle, played competitive Ultimate. So I actually was fairly thin and fit, even though I always felt fat. Like I always felt fat, like looking back, it was crazy. And then also too, you'd burn so many calories because it was pretty much a marathon all weekend that it wouldn't be weird for me to, you know, use some sort of recreational drug and then eat an entire cheesecake, which happened. And so I came out here to Seattle with food managing my feelings, and I ended up getting exposed. I was an accountant who worked for a large accounting firm. And for those in the Pacific Northwest, I remember it getting dark at 3:30 and working till 9 o'clock at night. And it literally felt like I was working around the clock, and I found ways of shortcutting school. And so with that, life got complicated.
5 minute mark. Sorry to interrupt.
No worries. Thank you. Appreciate the gentle reminder. And so, you know, the point I'm trying to make there is life got complicated, you know, and then I ended up going to a religious institution, and that was actually fairly effective. Like the ability of projecting feelings onto something outside of myself, looking back, was helpful. And actually found my partner there, who I'm no longer with, but found that person in 2010, instantly started having kids. So life gets complicated. You know, first kid in 2012, started an MBA program to pretty much like, and this is being candid, to avoid my partner because I just didn't know how to deal. And so I was just like, I'll just put it into something, you know, more complicated. Financially, we were in $250,000 of debt. Had a second kid in 2014 during the program. This was an evening MBA. I'm at UW. And so things with my depression, anxiety peaked. I was very, very over, you know, in my opinion, overweight from my experience. And I started really ramping up my therapy, my outside therapy. You know, my therapist recommended OA. And so I ended up coming into the rooms in late 2015. And it was a miracle. I got off food probably within like the recreational sugar. I just heard it in the room enough. And I was like, I'm just going to start there. I started with, you know, the ones that I would just be additive and just kind of worked my way down through elimination to figure out, yeah, it's absolutely recreational as well as artificial sweeteners. And that's become my abstinence. In addition to that, when I got off the foods, one of the things I identified is that feelings are inconvenient. And what I mean by that is feeling feelings for the first time was very, very difficult. Excuse me one second. My robot vacuum is going off, so I just want to turn it off. Like even just that, like what I just did there, like is such a miracle because I want you guys to love me and like me. To take a pause there to just do something for me is huge. So I'll take credit to my, or not take credit personally, but credit to my higher power for giving me that presence of being here. So feelings are definitely inconvenient, but also I've learned in this program, feelings are not facts. I actually came out to myself in 2016. Once I got off the food, I started having like definitely, you know, some definite feelings there. And in 2017, I learned that we were pregnant with our third, a beautiful daughter. And I ended up divorcing and separating late like pretty much right after she was born, I separated and got divorced in 2018. And I just kept coming back to the rooms. So I've completely transformed my day-to-day in the rooms, like literally just jumping into the deep end. And it's all of the people in this room right here that have helped me get through. So I'm just grateful to you guys. You guys are my higher power, you know, anything outside of me, but then, you know, you guys are my immediate family there. So, you know, I do get some outside therapy there, but with that, I'm going to go ahead and showcase some of my photos and I'll just kind of quickly recap, you know, what we've been talking about here, kind of go through. Can I get a verbal that you guys can see a photo of a kid that I still love?
You can see it.
So this is young Jared sitting in between his two brothers. This is definitely one of those glamour shots that you would get at church as a young kid. One funny thing is my parents were always about, you know, identity. So I do want to talk about, like, we always had to look good, always had to wear collared shirts and khakis to look good. And so identity was very important. Let's go to the next photo here. So this is like really to talk about like directly the exercise bulimic. So this is me playing competitive ultimate for Ohio State University. And yeah, this is fat. This is what looked like fat to me. And looking back, I can obviously see that I have a disease. This is after getting married. This is probably 2012, right around when we had our first kid. And this is our first son, Max. Absolutely precious. Glad to have him in my life for sure. Image was everything. Instagram life, everything was all about the outside, not about the inside. So I effectively had the skills that I had and used those skills to look good. And it got me a lot. It gets me a lot in the world, like straight up. And yet it created an internal challenge of unhappiness and having to leverage ways of managing the deprecating feelings I had for myself. This photo is in San Francisco, Blue Bottle Coffee, probably ate two croissants before this. I still love this Jared too, because he was trying the best with everything that he knew. Like the decisions I was making were rational. I just was avoiding feelings. I was avoiding life. I was avoiding, regretfully, my wife at the time. I want to hug that Jared for sure. And then this is what it is today. So here are my kids. This was a big photo for me because this one is about being a single dad, three kids, still Instagrammable, but not in the same heart. This was more for me. This whole photo shoot was for me. And the other thing I have to give credit for is my ex-wife, Natalie. She deserves a ton of credit in this. She's raised these kids incredibly and has been very gracious and grateful as I've been working on myself to give me the space to work on myself so that I can be fully present with the kids. And my life is still unmanageable and I'm powerless over food. And so like things like practical, like I cannot have the kids' food until the Friday before I get them, and I have her deliver the food. So I've integrated my OA program into my co-parenting. And so those are some of the photos I wanted to share. Not for the vanity. You know, I think that's a lot of the reasons why people come in. My total weight loss was right around 100 pounds. But I'm still in ways searching for the sanity. I had such momentum. I was like a cruise ship of, you know, 33 plus years of doing it on my own. And so I've been so aggravated, like trying to get, you know, these feelings to stop being so strong, but I have to give myself grace. And I'm speaking to myself in this situation. I can observe it is like, I have to give myself more grace because I have 33 years of momentum around numbing my feelings. And so I'll keep coming back until, you know, those times start to balance out. So what changed? I talked about that therapist, Stanford educated. We tried reading every single psychology article. I remember reading through like 50 page deep studies. I was a psychology major and doubled in accounting. And so reading those nerdy things just made sense. And so he was like, what about OA? And I was like, Alcoholics Anonymous for food? I was like, get the F out of here. And, you know, I thought about Tyler Durden from Fight Club for those movie fans out there, basements, coffee, and cigarettes, like the way it's portrayed in LA. But as soon as I walked into the room, it was everything but. I heard my story instantly. And I just haven't stopped coming back, man. I love hearing stories. I love the honesty of the rooms. Even just as person of the world, the humanity in these rooms is just so attractive to me. And so I'm just so grateful for your stories and your shares and being of service. I do want to take a quick couple seconds to just run through my tools I've been using. Meetings for sure. The OA LA Intergroup podcast. I've been hearing a lot more about Region One here, doing a bunch of podcasts, but still I keep coming back to the LA Intergroup podcast. They have hundreds of podcasts available. For those that are taking notes, CASA, K-A-S-A. If you search the OALA Intergroup podcast, her story is my story. And so I've been praying to my higher power that I can meet her someday and just let her know how much she's impacted my life. The pen. So I take 10 step when I can. I have a card that I use, which is an opening and closing ceremony, just talking about things I was grateful for, things that I'm not. And I'm definitely imperfect with that. I haven't done it in like 2 weeks right now. I'm still remaining absent, but I can definitely feel very itchy. Use the phone. I reach out when I really need it, especially to sponsor. I don't talk to my sponsor on a daily basis, and that's okay. I'd love to be able to, but I'm not able to be willing right now. And again, that's okay. It's a loose garment for me. And I try to be of service when I can. So what it's like now, OA is really integrated in my life. And I just think that's important, multiple programs. And I want to use the remaining of my time to talk about one of the reasons why I asked is about being a man in OA, as well as just kind of some of the other labels I identified with at the top of the call. And just some from my experience, a couple of things I thought about in meditating. And I talked to a lot of the guys in the men's focus. We have a men's Northgate OA meeting that meets on Monday nights, 7 o'clock. I'm going to wrap up here because I want to give us a little bit of time for Q&A as well. So I really appreciate the time. From my experience, you know, I was desperate enough to get in the rooms that I didn't see the labels. And so for that, I am grateful to have that desperation. So I actually didn't struggle coming into the rooms because I tried everything else. I tried the dieting. I tried the exercise. It all just didn't work. And so for me, in my experience, I didn't see gender as a hurdle. And yet I have to speak tonight from that angle because I understand. I've seen it through other people's shares, especially in the men's group. The vulnerability of men with men in those focus groups seems to open up the heart of the compulsive overeater who still struggles. And I think that's just absolutely huge. To have those common traits in a more focused manner is clutch. Just the directness. And yet, I have a note here and I'm just going to read it off because it made me laugh, which was whether you knit during a meeting, whether you stand during a meeting, whether you smile during a meeting, or whether you cry during a meeting, you are there. You're at the meeting and you are seen and you're unified with me. There's unity and diversity in these rooms. I love it. I love everything. Like the needles of the knitting folk in the meetings I've been in, like what's cool about that is their life, you know, is like one knit at a time, you know, they're building something beautiful. And I feel like that's the same way my OA program. So it's very visible to see that. And whether you're a long time or first member, like I sit with you. And from my experience, the weirder the group, the better. And that includes outside of the rooms. You know, I've just observed that. And my call or thing I want to leave you with in conclusion is if you identify with like a focus group and you haven't joined one, definitely check them out, especially now in this Zoom time, like check them out. Like that unity and diversity of having the common trait that you identify with, you'll definitely hear something from my experience. And then vice versa, if you find yourself only going to those common trait rooms, you know, I challenge you to be a little bit more open. Again, from my experience, because I've learned so much from all of the people, whether you're standing while you're sharing or sitting while you're sharing or stretching while you're sharing or crying while you're sharing, I have an opportunity of learning from you. And so, you know, in that, I'm Jared, a compulsive overeater who still struggles. I'm powerless over food. My life is unmanageable, but I've come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And with that, I'll keep coming back and just stoked to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ava and Jared, so much for your beautiful shares. I want to start out by just telling a little bit about myself and my backstory, my origin story, if you will, how I came to OA. Some of my first memories are of food, of my favorite food, what food I would eat when I was stressed, and what felt good to me. There was a lot of trauma in my background. And food was my best friend when I had none. Food was how I got out of the world that I couldn't control. And when I coun't learn that I couldn't rely on the adults around me and the people who were supposed to care for me, I knew food would be there. So me and food go back a long time. We're really We're best friends. We were. And now the relationship is changing to be something a little healthier. But I had always tried to control my weight and things just didn't work for me, or, you know, it would fluctuate greatly depending on if I was in depression or anxiety cycle. And so that would kind of be where I was at with my weight. And I think we've all internalized a lot of really harmful messages about our body. And I certainly held on to those very dearly. I was always very frustrated with my weight because I always needed to portray the idea that I had it all together. Like, I come from a family of addicts, but I wasn't like them in my head. You know, I was the good one. I was the smart one. I was the one that didn't give anybody any trouble. I was average student, but, you know, I got through and all of that stuff. So, but yeah, it was that I was different. I was different than the rest of my family, and I had to hold on to that difference. Otherwise, my self-worth was gone, because that's where it lived. So, always portraying this perfect exterior, but when you're heavy, in my mind, that meant I was broken, and that everybody could see that I was broken. So there was a lot of self-loathing, a lot of really negative self-talk that came around that to try and control my weight. And so this fight went back and forth and back and forth. One of the best things I did was move away to go to college. And I got a bachelor's degree, but more importantly, I got therapy, outside help. And so they gave it away at our school for free. So I was on board. And so starting to unpack all of those things was really important for me. And I just knew that's where I had to be, kind of a first things first kind of thing for me to handle all of that. But eventually I got to the point where I was ready to address my food issue. I wanted to put that crutch down. I didn't want it anymore because I was desperate and I knew it wasn't helping me. There was a time when it was, and I didn't have any other tools except for it. And, you know, it is what it is, but now it was time. And so I heard of OA. Me and a friend decided to go into a room and start listening to stories, and they were my stories. And I held back, of course, because I'm protective of myself. I've learned how to do that. And so I was like, well, let's go see what this weird food cult is about. And and so I came in and I just sat and listened. And like a lot of times, because of that projection, you know, something in me wants to be like, okay, well, I'll hop in. And then in about 2 years' time, I'm going to be, what is it, president? What do you guys all call the top, you know, like chair? And I'll have everything in control and it'll all be, you know. And so, but something in me, that higher wisdom in myself, said, Cheryl, just shut your mouth and listen in the kindest possible way, you know, just shh and listen. And so I did. And one after one, you know, I'm a newcomer. So everyone comes in and is like, oh yeah, the program is great. And it's so awesome and blah, blah, blah. And then finally it felt like another place that I had to pretend to be okay for a little while. That's all I was seeing. I couldn't take those blinders off. And I was telling my friend this while we were at a restaurant eating a ton of food. I was telling my friend this issue that I was having. And she said to me, and she was like, well, do you want to go to the meeting? You know, we're already late. And I was like, all right, let's hop in. And so we got in just in time for shares. And one after one, people talked about their struggle in the program. And that gave me hope. That made me feel like I belonged. Because they weren't pretending that they had it all under control. They were saying, I don't know what to do. Or I'm lost, I'm scared. Those were things that when I said them in my family didn't know how to take it because I wasn't the one who was lost and scared. I was the one who knew the way. So I got to be part of a family at that point where I was safe to be lost. I was safe to be a mess. It was safe for me to be who I was, no matter what that was. And from then on, the transformations came. I stopped recreational sugar and have been off for a year and a little over a year and a half now. My wonderful sponsor has helped me through the steps and at the pace I needed to go at. And it has uncovered so much. I'm now sponsoring. I have a lot of sponsees and I love them and they give so much to me. Because the more stories I hear and the more stories I get to be involved in, the healthier I am. Because I get to learn over and over and over again that there's no A plus in OA, which is what I came in to do, was to get an A plus in OA. That was my goal. I was like, oh, just like everything else, I'm going to be really great. And then, you know, whatever. This is a deep psychic change, I think, that, you know, that kind of has settled into my brain and really helped me change those neurological pathways to go a different way, which is really amazing. So kind of talking first about my mental health journey, I have depression, anxiety, CPTSD, and I'm sure more things that I haven't been diagnosed with yet. We're just waiting. One of the things that came in with me to this program was this idea that I needed to always be proving myself. I am not too disabled to do this. I can do this just like anybody else can do it. And I don't have to change anything to fit the way that you guys do it is the way that I have to do it. Because if I do it any different, it's less than, it's not as good a program. And then I come into the rooms and I hear story after story of people who do it this way and people who say this and people who do this. And it just bolsters every different, even if there are things that I don't particularly want to take part in. It's amazing the differences that people have to be able to move forward. So if you have differences, that's kind of the message that I wanted to take with my mental health story, is that if I can think that about everyone else's story, then I have to be able to think that about myself and my story, that my story can be helpful and that my story is important just how it is. It doesn't have to be some perfection to be helpful and useful and important. And oftentimes that's not the helpful way. So your story is important. It brings hope to others in need and it needs to be told. We have a unique opportunity to teach each other about mental health and self-love. Other people's stories are so important to hear because we need to practice that love and acceptance for others. If we can do it for others, we have hope to do it for ourselves. Because some of the people who I've encountered, they're telling my story, they have my issues, there's so much in common that I have with them. And I can look at them and I can love them and accept them for whatever program they're on. So if that's the case for them, I can do it for me. That was really important. For the second half, I'm going to talk a little bit more about, I'm atheist in a program that has a lot of God words, which is totally fine with me now. I'm good about it now. But one of the things that kind of came out to me was that I was talking at a meeting at some point in time, and my boyfriend was fixing his noise-canceling headphones, and he's like, you talk a lot about God to people, and like, you use the word God a lot, like, you know, I'm just curious about that because we're both atheists, you know what I mean? And I'm like, yeah, I'm just kind of translating and then saying what other people want to hear. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to ruffle anyone's feathers by saying different words than other people are saying. And it sounded so reasonable in my head. And then once I said it out loud, I was like, oh, that's not how I want to live my life. One of my amends to myself was being able to take up space. And so for me, in that situation, it hit me that that means I get to use the words that I want to use in a meeting. I think that it just showed that I don't have to give up the values that I find important to conform to someone else's idea of how a program needs to be worked. For me, that can be saying, may I have the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, so on and so forth. You all know the rest. And I get to be able to take that space for myself. And if people have questions about it, great. I get to answer those questions and I get to be in that space and I get to share myself with other people in a really vulnerable way. And here is where I thought to myself, if I can't do it here, where can I do it? The greatest thing I've ever done for myself is to think about how I can help others. And the thing that really got me was that I need to be able to be okay with practicing. I need to be able to show other people practicing. I need to be able to show other people failure. I need to be able to show other people, you know, mistakes and to be vulnerable. Because without that vulnerability, I can't help anyone because I can't help myself. That was something that was really important and such a leap forward in my journey, you know? And so I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look up Atheist Center free thinking kind of meetings. And I found one and I go to one. And it was something it was a gift I gave to myself, to be able to use the words I wanted to use and to be able to the unity and the diversity. And for me, I wasn't in unity, I was in conformity. And there was a difference there for me. And so now that I have my own special place, I get to be in the unity and not in the conformity kind of sickness mindset. And so that's been really amazing that by me having my boundaries and me having my space and me honoring myself, I'm able to then be part of something more than I was beforehand and in just a more genuine way. We get to gain the hope that there is a way to move forward in this world with others, without isolation, regardless of opinions, that there is a place we belong regardless of who we are. Only a desire to stop eating is required. The rest is our experience, strength, and hope. I'm really grateful. I'm grateful for this opportunity. My higher power is all of you and the part of myself that loves myself. And so I'm just grateful to all of you for your stories and your ears and your time and your faces and being there so I don't have to be isolated anymore and so that I have hope that there's a million different ways for me to get to wherever it is in the future I want to be. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you, Jared. And thank you, Eva. We're open for questions and shares now. Please confine your sharing and your questions to the topic, which are finding hope in our differences, unity and diversity. And I'll call on you as you put your hands up. Amy, go ahead.
Hi, everybody. And thank you so much, Eva, Cheryl, and Jared, for sharing your strength and hope. Unfortunately, I came in a little bit late, so I didn't really hear Eva's story too much, but I really did relate a whole lot with Jared and Cheryl. The whole thing about being an emotional eater, I've been abstinent since March of this year, but I've been in program for the last 15 years and took me that long to actually really start working the program and getting serious about it. Before I had my doubts, you know, I was basically what I would call like a part-time OAer. I really didn't work it, but I kept going to the meetings. I just wanted to say that I can really relate to that whole like feeling your feelings type of thing. Now that I'm not numbing myself out with the food, it's amazing the difference. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Amy. Krista, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Krista. I'm a grateful recovering compulsive overeater. And thank you all for your shares. I think it's always amazing when I take aside what we can see or maybe what I'm hearing of our differences, how much we really have in common. And I've really noticed that a lot in all of the speakers that we've had so far this weekend and also in the other sessions I've been in. And so I really thank you all for sharing that. I guess I don't have any specific questions. I just wanted to share that, you know, part of the diversity I brought when I first started going to meetings was I was like the youngest person in a meeting by at least 20 years, maybe 30. And that was really hard for me at first, but I was also like, I'm the oldest of six kids. And I was just kind of used to being like around people older than me. I was a very mature kid, you know? So it was kind of like, it was weird, but then it was kind of comforting and felt normal to me at the same time. And I was just really grateful to be able to see what my life could look like in recovery. And that was one of the advantages of it, is that I got to see like, hey, if you live this spiritual life, you can get to 50, 60, 70 and have a life of meaning and have a life where food doesn't rule everything. And that was a great gift. I also felt like I got a lot of support and recovery in the rooms around being lesbian and just being able to share about that openly. I also had the advantage of being in Portland, Oregon, so that was a lot easier maybe than other places, but you know, that was a huge part of why I started eating the way that I did, because of all the struggles of coming out and all the challenges with my family, right? And it was the way I stuffed my feelings for so long. It helped me survive, it helped me get through it. But when I was ready to do something else, I was glad that I knew about OA and that I got support. Can I ask a question or am I done?
Go ahead and ask a quick question.
Okay. The question, and I put it in the chat, is just because I just am looking for resources for sponsees. Like, do any of you know of BIPOC Zoom OA meetings or people of color or any of those kind of diversity meetings? Thank you.
We'll probably put some of those resources in the chat. Our speaker team tonight put together a list of resources as a handout. So I would refer you to that handout.
Thank you. All right.
Robin, I have you up next.
Hi, I'm Robin. I'm a compulsive overeater. And thank you for sharing. I think one of the gifts that I've gotten from this is going into a meeting and maybe things just going differently and I get so much something completely different from what I might have even thought I would get from the meeting. So thank you so much for all of the things that you shared. And I recognized so much about, especially this time around, feeling really conscious about whenever I speak, wanting to sound like I have it together, or I don't know. I've never felt so nervous about sharing before. And I just felt like you guys were sharing, you know, just how you learned to be who you really were, to share who you really are in meetings and sharing who you really are to yourself even. And so I related so much to that. And I feel like I loved hearing, if I can't do it here, where am I going to do it? Because this really is where I come for recovery. And it's just helping me to recognize, you know, I just want to be who I am in this meeting in recovery. You guys have really shared some great stuff about doing that and about what that's gotten for you from this program. So just thank you so much. I'm just really glad I was here and I'm glad I got to hear everything you guys had to share. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I have a couple of questions from the chat. What do you mean by recreational sugar? I've never heard of sugar referred to in this way before.
I define, from my experience, recreational sugar as any sugar that is above and beyond an apple. So my recreational sugar, from my experience, starts with bananas, which tend to be higher in sugar, all the way through very, very calorie dense, sugar-based candies, desserts, and things like that. In addition to that, the artificial sweetener would be like, I struggled in my eliminations with things like Crystal Light or Propel water stuff, or even sugar-free gum. And from my experience in the rooms, I've heard things like people obsessing about 37 sticks of sugar-free gum you know, compulsively. And so I've abstained from that because I also like breath mint to me is recreational sugar.
Thank you. Okay, Miriam, if you'd like to question or share.
Marianne, compulsive overeater, just wanted to ask Cheryl and Jared, how do you pray if you're, or how do you translate prayer if your higher power is the group? And Eva, I wanted to ask you if there are ways we can attract more people of color or welcome them when they show up in the rooms.
Well, I can take the prayer. For me, I always refer it to take it to my higher power. So that means share it at meetings. And then when it's also the part of myself that loves myself, it's a lot of times in meditation or in writing. So I will give myself my own writing prompt. So like, one of the things I've been struggling with recently is how do I set loving boundaries for myself? So I will put it out to a group and I'll just ask, like, how do you set loving boundaries for yourself during one of my shares? I'd love to talk with you afterward. Or I will write it at the top of a piece of paper and work on that piece of paper for a little while when I have the willingness to do so.
Mine briefly would be when we used to be in the rooms, my higher power used to be the center of the circle. So many of the meetings I went to, actually, we would all sit in a circle. And there were times where I would just speak to the center of the circle and just kind of leave my share there and be like, I'm walking away from this at the end of the meeting. And it was very therapeutic to me. And there's other examples I have. So feel free to reach off to me. I'm off to the side. But with that, I'll hand it over to Eva.
Sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. I just wondered how people can be more welcoming of people of color when they're in the rooms and how we could attract more people of color to the program. If you have any ideas.
When you say people of color, you refer to Black people?
Well, I think it's more generally for people who are not Caucasian.
Okay. Well, I think I always heard in the program that this is about attraction and not about promotion. So I think we run into people of different races and nationalities and all the time. And I think by behaving in a certain way, we can get to attract that people. What I do is when I feel that the environment is reliable, I open myself. I'm open to talk about my own eating disorder. And I know there's people that's going to judge me, but I know there's people that is going to ask me, how can they get what I want? How can they get what I have so far? And I'm a work in progress, but as far as I can get people to come to come closer to the program, that is perfect. So for me, it would be like just doing the best we can with our own recovery, because we are running into different types of people all the time.
Thank you. I have a question from the chat. The idea that sometimes people find it difficult to attend a meeting where they are the only diverse person there. How have you all handled that situation while still keeping true to yourself?
A lot of my diversities are not externally knowable, but a lot of times you can find maybe starting with individual groups where you, because I know that for me, I live in Seattle. So a lot of our groups try to be as welcoming as possible. There's not as many maybe cultural boundaries in some ways than there might be in other ways. And so being able to maybe look for meetings, especially in the area of Zoom, being able to look for meetings that might have your interest at heart specifically, or meetings that might be more welcoming to those areas, or meetings that have a really diverse population in general, but then walking into the room and having that bravery to do so it's hard and support is really needed. So I like to have that support system kind of underneath me if possible. But not all of us are lucky enough to have that kind of support system. So bookending with somebody who you know is really supportive can be really helpful as well.
I think it's a great question, and I'll start with, I don't know. And from my experience, use the resources and maybe take stock on the resources that are available to you. So whether it be writing out your feelings or thoughts about it, and or before heading to that meeting, leveraging a sponsor for some wisdom outside of you, being able to share your feelings, concerns, things like that. And I think for me, like I'm privileged in the fact that I tend to be curious, have a natural curiosity, which I think is correlative to having an open mind. And so if you can observe in your own, you know, history or kind of like what you're working through, that you tend to be more closed-minded, that would be an opportunity to maybe talk to your sponsor and maybe even have that sponsor come to you. And I think that diversity of meetings and sponsors can still enable you to keep coming back, whether it's continuing to work through your sponsor until you can find a meeting that works for you. Great question.
I've got one I'm going to just summarize from the chat. It's about someone who is trans masculine non-binary person. They've started testosterone and they just feel they have more of a male mind. I'm reading their words. I feel like I would like to connect with and understand men in the meetings more, but I'm worried about not being accepted. So it's at that bottom line of feeling different.
First of all, courageous is the word that comes to mind with a question like that. So thank you for your bravery in saying that, and also to be your authentic self. So just starting there, I pause and just welcome you. Yeah, I mean, I envision a situation where, you know, let's just say at the men's group, we'd have you. And I think there is a space. I mean, we've even had women come into the group, and, you know, I think there's wisdom in the literature that points to, you know, the focus, you know, groups and welcoming within those groups. And per my understanding and the autonomy through the traditions, my understanding is that you would be welcomed. And if you weren't, and or were feeling discrimination, this again is coming to the diversity of having a sponsor. And that sponsor can advocate to you, to the owner of that group or whoever the chair is for that group, to help reconcile that space for you. Reach out to me. I'll be your advocate. So if you don't have a sponsor, my number's in my name and I'll advocate for you without question. Because without qualification, you're welcome in these rooms as long as you have a desire. So thank you.
I would like to add something to the past question, if possible. I think being different doesn't make us not addicted people. I mean, I see myself as an addicted people when I'm in a group. And I know from the beginning that I have everything in common with the people I'm surrounded by. So doesn't matter my color, the color of my skin, my sexual preference, anything. I think how to go into a meeting being different is just having the conviction that it's about me, it's about my well-being, it's about my recovery. And the rest of the room doesn't know how much can or what I can bring for them too. Knowing that my experience is valuable, but overall knowing that this is about my recovery. And sometimes even in the meetings, it has to be about me, because that's something I learned in the program, to be selfish. And when it comes to that, to my recovery, I'm selfish, sometimes even with my colleagues at the group, thinking about my recovery and my well-being. Thank you.
Thank you, Eva. Ambrose, would you like to ask your question or share?
Hi, my name's Ambrose, compulsive overeater. So I'm neurodivergent myself. I am autistic, PTSD, possibly ADHD, depression, anxiety. Who knows what else? But I have times where I'm not verbal and phone calls are really difficult for me and things like that. And I'm wondering, like right now I do have a sponsor and she's been really kind when I wasn't able to do phone calls, switched to texting with me and then emailing. And so we've figured it out between myself and her. But I'm curious, like going forward when it's time for me to sponsor people, like how difficult will that be? Like what way can I go about taking care of myself the way that I need to, and also being able to be of service?
Absolutely. I can feel it at first. What really helps me as I go into it is to remember that when I put down a boundary, around what I need for myself and my mental health, it helps the sponsee that I'm working with, because it teaches, because I've had it done to me, and it teaches me that I'm allowed to have boundaries and that I'm allowed to not be all right now. And so being able to say, like, look, this is what's going on. This is what's happening with me. This is how it happens. Let's work together and figure out a plan. If at some point in time I can't pick up the phone, who, for me, I there are some times where I am not as available. And so, because there are some routines that I need to have in place. And so a lot of times what I'll do is have people really find a support group so that they can kind of spread out that support that's needed onto multiple different people. So that's just my way that I do it, is that you're a sponsor, you're not their only lifeline to the entire world. And that's really helped me be able to sponsor when things are difficult mentally for me.
Maybe coming at the question from just a different angle, just for maybe, you know, the facets of the diamond per se. One of the benefits of this time right now is availability of resources. This is Region 1. You have a, locally for me, I have the Greater Seattle Intergroup. I have the Region 1 and World Service. And in fact, per my understanding, World Service has a diversity board as well. And so being able to leverage and reach out to those resources to potentially find a peer that identifies somewhere similar to you and reaching out to see if anybody has the availability of helping be of service for you, so that as you sponsor, you may be able to find somebody with that common, you know, identity, so that you can bounce ideas off of in those ways to help guide you through that wisdom. And even if that person isn't exactly, you can still ask for, you know, what it is that you want in a peer or a partner in recovery. And so just thinking about it from a different angle, as well as just the fact that we have so many resources right now at our disposal, it's almost overwhelming.
Mac, I see your blue hand up.
Yeah, I guess this is partially a share. Actually, I came into the rooms in OA about 25 years ago. I did real well. I got a good sponsor, and I did real well. Lost a lot of weight and everything, and working the program, and did service, spoke at meetings and stuff like that. And then very late in life, I came out as a gay man. That and some things that were going on at work, at that time, when I was in OA before, I stayed absent for about 5 years, but then these things started coming up in my life. One thing was coming out. The other thing is things were sort of falling apart at work, and unfortunately I went back to my old friend food, and that went into relapse. I spent a long time there as a lot of shame connected to it. Here I was doing real well in OA and everything, and I blew it. I was putting all this shame on myself. I finally got to that point about a year ago to come back into OA, realizing that this was the only place I was going to get any abstinence or any recovery. So it was, by coming back in OA and starting where I started before, and working the steps and working the program and stuff. And I've always liked to think that a lot of meanings then was, it works if you work it and you're worth it. That's what I finally came to the belief of, that I was worth it. And whether I spent a lot of time in relapse, that was in the past. There isn't anything I can do about it. Talk about in the program about you can't change the past and you can't change the future until you get there. It was really important to me, and I found myself, when I get back to the meetings, and the same thing was there, that when I was in AA 8 years ago, that there was a lot of love from the people in the program. And so it's good to be back. I know one of the things I say to myself in the past, I think probably from when I was growing up, is that, I'm supposed to do everything myself, and I can't. And I have a sticker in my big book that says, I can't, God can. I think I'll let God. So that's where I am, and I'm happy to be back, and I'm happy to, you know, be with all you people today and in the meetings I go to. Thanks.
Thank you, Mac. Raj K. from Vancouver.
Raj from Vancouver, compulsive overeater. I joined a little bit late. The part I heard was sort of a person saying they're a trans person, and then the speaker was just sharing about the inclusion in the committees, in the meetings rather. And that's a good message about acceptance. And, you know, it's something I'm a person of color, and it's been something that for me has been difficult in the meetings, because sometimes being the only minority, it's hard to relate. I've been to, for example, there's a very people of color meeting that's on Zoom on Saturdays at 11, and it's just a completely different type of acceptance where I almost feel that I can kind of relax and be myself, because there's always this, not that, you know, we should focus on our differences, but the reality is if you're in a room with 45 people, most of them are women, and you're the only man, and you're the only minority, of course you're going to feel it, you know? And oftentimes I just don't want to go back to some of the meetings, and it just doesn't feel comfortable for me. And so this message that you're talking about sort of tells me that I belong, but my baggage, my PTSD, the bullying that I experienced, and everything else is programmed in my mind to the point where even coming to a meeting, I find extremely difficult. And it's not that, it's something else. You know, it's like, well, there's a clique of people that are in control, and they're the inside crowd. And because they're inside crowd, and I feel like an outsider, and I don't want to go there. Thank you for the message. Yes.
Thank you, Raj. Linda, if you'd like to share or ask a question.
My name is Linda Jane. I'm a compulsive eater from the Chicago area. I went to a virtual region convention in June, and I attended a meeting similar to this one. It was an LGBTQ plus friends meeting. And out of that meeting, someone set up a WhatsApp loop of the people that were in that meeting. And it was people all over the world of all different kinds of sexual preferences or gender identity. It's a wonderful loop of people. And I'd be happy to, if you want to text me, I've got my phone number in the participants list, and then I can invite you into this loop. I don't know how else to do this other than giving someone else's name, and then I'd break their identity. But what it would do was it could join people from region one into this loop. There's people on that loop right now that are mostly region 6 and 9. And out of that loop too, someone suggested, well, why don't we get together and do a step study? And I ended up leading a step study, and it was a mixture of LGBT and friends. It was wonderful. It was great. We made it through all 12 steps, and we're still meeting. Send me a text if you'd like to be in this loop. It's a WhatsApp loop.
Thank you, Linda. Nancla, would you like to ask a question or share?
I'm just wondering if you use the tools and which ones you use.
Yes, absolutely. So for me, the step 10 is essential every single day, because I have a rule. My rule is I'm brutally honest, first of all, with myself. If I start lying to myself, I know it's easy to build. It's like a skyscraper. It goes fast, super, super fast and super, super high. And it takes me super, so deep. So step 10 every single day. And well, I always try to live in so much awareness. And for that, I do meditation, I do yoga. And that keeps me aware a good part of the time, not all the time. Honestly, it's a daily practice. It's a day by day and sometimes it's not daily, it's hourly, and sometimes it's secondly, because sometimes things get hard and it's like it is. So for me, it's always trying to be aware of the things that I do and just correct what I have to correct. And the other thing I also use as a tool is meditation, and I also pray.
For me, writing has always been a really big thing for me. I love to write, and I wasn't doing it for a really long time. And so I got some partners in recovery together, and we all three of us kind of had heard them say those kind of things in meetings and that it was difficult to write and blah, blah, blah. But we decided to meet up and have like a writing group. And that was really helpful for me because my higher power is the group. I was like, okay, well, I have to take it to my higher power. And my higher power was other people who also wanted to do writing. And so we would meet on Zoom beforehand. In the before times, we met in coffee shop, but on Zoom and now, and we just thumb through, randomly pick a thing in the big book or the 12 and 12 or whatever we want to do and read it and then write on it. So other people really help me use the tools when I don't want to, because I will have a billion different reasons. Then I'm like, if I can get myself to text someone, then somehow it just like gets the ball rolling. So I guess writing and telephone / texting / emailing or whatever can kind of get me around whatever willingness block I have.
I'm a person of metaphor. So like my foundation of my recovery is the gift of desperation, because, you know, my life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over food. And then I see the tools of recovery as really kind of like metaphorically like the house that, you know, like the each individual kind of piece of wood that is like in the cement of that desperation. And then my program resides on top. So the beauty of the tools from my experience is the diversification of them. And so instead of just having like my house built on one post of just going to meetings, I have all of these different areas. So like if one of the areas gets either wet or, you know, I'm not keeping up, I have all these other areas to keep my program going. So like service has been like clutch. Like right now I'm in a meeting where I'm the Zoom host, and frankly, it's annoying, but also it gets me to meetings. So there's concurrent truths. Writing has been absolutely huge. So like I wake up with like an amnesia of like thought, and like in order to get that constipated thought out, I use the tool of writing. And the next thing you know, like just pulling a little string at it, like it just all falls out. It's classic. Telephone is clutch. And again, like the OA podcast, especially when I started out, I'm a podcast nerd. I think it's just because of my dyslexia, but like hearing that backlog. And again, I know I really focused on the LA intergroup. They have a vast library, but we're also building a great library here in Region 1. And I'm really stoked to have all the speakers, you know, being recorded for this. And, you know, I've even thought about like, you know, we have speakers in the GSI, Greater Seattle Intergroup. And that's been one for me that was absolutely valuable. Because like I said, I found Cass A, whose story is like so mine. It's classic. Like I sent it to my mom so that my mom understands what it is that I went through. So it's not in my voice, that it's somebody else who I completely identify with. And so now she knows why I'm in program, and integrating that into my life has been clutch through the tools, you know, attraction, not promotion. Thanks.
I want to thank our speakers for very enriching shares and information. Cheryl, Jared, and Eva, thank you so much for giving of yourselves and your time tonight.